From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Hatred can never answer hatred. Violence is injustice. All violence is injustice. Responding to violence by violence can only bring more violence.
Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. A grieving family tells Bush, not in our son's name. And the Reverend Jerry Falwell's attacks on gay men and lesbians and civil libertarians marks the opening salvo against dissident voices in wartime. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Bush administration officials said yesterday that a military strike against Osama bin Laden and his supporters in Afghanistan is not imminent, citing the need to gain better intelligence about their whereabouts. Following a NATO briefing in Brussels, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz told reporters, "I think it can't be stressed enough that everybody who's waiting for military action needs to rethink this thing." Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made similar remarks Tuesday at a briefing on Capitol Hill. The administration continued to work on assembling an international coalition without great success. The British newspaper The Guardian is reporting that U.S. and British officials backtracked yesterday on threats to oust the ruling Taliban after Pakistan threatened to withdraw its cooperation. Pakistan's foreign minister reminded the Western allies of failed attempts to impose governments on Afghanistan and said any attempt to repeat the mistakes of the British and the Soviet Union, quote, is a recipe for great suffering for the people of Afghanistan. Islamabad is concerned that Washington plans to replace the Taliban with leaders drawn from the ethnic minorities in the opposition Northern Alliance. Pakistan regards the alliance as an enemy and ally of India, its longtime rival on the subcontinent. Islamabad is also concerned that Washington is not seeking UN approval for a military operation and has only limited support from the Muslim world. Military sources in Islamabad say Pakistan has agreed to open its airspace to U.S. fighters, but is much more reluctant to allow U.S. troops to be stationed there. Meanwhile, during a hastily arranged visit to Washington, Foreign Minister Ahmed Maher of Egypt, a key U.S. ally, said his country could back an American campaign, but he said Egypt still wants proof of bin Laden's role. The Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, is in a brief briefing for journalists, praised Western civilization today as superior to that of the Islamic world and urged Europe to, quote, reconstitute itself on the basis of its Christian roots. Berlusconi was in Berlin to discuss the international cooperation against terrorism with the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the German Chancellor. He said, "We should be confident of the superiority of our civilization, which consists of a value system that has given people widespread prosperity in those countries that embrace it and guarantees respect for human rights and religion. This respect certainly does not exist in Islamic countries," he said. The Italian Prime Minister went on to say the West is bound to occidentalize and conquer new people. It has done it with the communist world and part of the Islamic world, but unfortunately a part of the Islamic world is 1,400 years behind. Berlusconi, who's been criticized for the force Italian police used against anti-globalization protesters in Genoa in July, said he saw a singular coincidence between the protesters and the terrorists who attacked New York and Washington. The terrorists, he said, were trying to stop the corrupting effect of Western civilization on the Islamic world, while, quote, the anti-globalization movement criticizes from within Western civilization, the Western way of life, trying to make Western civilization feel guilty. The Italian opposition and press harshly criticized the Italian prime minister. The newspaper La Repubblica said his remarks carried a tinge of fundamentalism and a hint of crusade, which are extremely dangerous in the current difficult situation. And Belgian Foreign Minister Louis Michel, who is leading an European Union mission to the Middle East, said today that he denounced Berlusconi's remarks as not in line with European decisions and European values. Thousands of jubilant Taliban protesters stormed the defunct U.S. embassy in the center of Kabul yesterday, setting fire to several cars and an outbuilding before symbolically ripping down the compound's giant U.S. seal. In the biggest rally since Afghanistan was threatened with attack 2 weeks ago, the demonstrators shouted, "We are the people of Kabul. We are ready for jihad," before burning an American flag and an effigy of President Bush, the last U.S. diplomats pulled out of the embassy in 1989. Millions of landmines dotted across Afghanistan are causing concern among Pentagon officials plotting movement of special forces. Landmine Action, a British-based campaign, estimates there are up to 1 million mines in the country. It dismissed a Pentagon figure of 10 million mines quoted in the Washington Post as a wild overestimate. Anti-landmines activists in the region say they pose a greater threat to fleeing civilians than they do to U.S. forces, who would know where the mines are and would have equipment to deal with them. Most of the mines were placed there during the war between the Soviet Union and the U.S.-backed Mujahideen in the 1980s. While the dead and missing toll rose towards 7,000 people and the stock market suffered its largest week's loss since the Great Depression due to the terrorist attack on the symbols of U.S. economic and military power, the stock of the weapon and surveillance industries has zoomed. This is a piece by Tom Turnipseed that appeared on Common Dreams. Stock values rose 39.9% for Armor Holdings, Inc., who specialize in bullet-resistant vests and flak jackets to armored vehicles and sells them to government agencies and multinational corporations, to 21% for Northrop Grumman Corporation, who sell weapons like B-2 stealth bomber, warships, and battlefield surveillance systems. Raytheon, meaning Light of the Gods, whose stock rose 37% and who sell 66% of their aerospace products to the U.S. Department of Defense, L3 Communications Holdings, whose stock gained 35.8% because they make specialized communication systems for satellite, avionics, and marine communications, Alliant Tech Systems, stock rose 23.5% last week because they sell about three-quarters of their gunpowder, smart bombs, tank mines, and rocket propulsion systems and other war-making products to the U.S. government. Meanwhile, the fear of terror syndrome caused security companies' stock on NASDAQ to soar. Envision Technologies rose 195.5%. They offer magnetic resonance imaging to check baggage and risk analysis. Visage Technologies went up 175.8% because they develop biometric technologies such as face recognition and fingerprint imaging with instantaneous surveillance applications. And this news from the Wall Street Journal: if the U.S. boosts defense spending in its quest to stop Osama bin Laden's alleged terrorist activities, there may be one unexpected beneficiary: Mr. bin Laden's family. Among its far-flung business interests, the well-heeled Saudi Arabian clan, which says it is estranged from Osama, is an investor in a fund established by Carlyle Group, a well-connected Washington merchant bank specializing in buyouts of defense and aerospace companies.
Broken gates, broken dishes, broken pots.
Everything is Broken, the best of Bob Dylan, here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Despite the Bush administration's refusal to actually release evidence that might link Osama bin Laden to the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, the mass media has lined up almost without exception in support of wide-ranging military action against Afghanistan and perhaps other countries. In yesterday's Washington Post, for example, the opinion page featured two allegedly opposing op-ed pieces side by side. The first column, called Imminent U.S. Military... There's a lot of smoke around here. The first column, called Imminent U.S. Military Action a Just Struggle, warning that progressives must support war despite inevitable mistakes, restrictions on civil liberties, and potentially unsavory alliances with murderous regimes. The second column charged that pacifists are immoral on the side of murderers, pro-fascist, and objectively pro-terrorist. This is what passes for debate on the question of war in the mass media. Almost lost in the media drumbeat is a growing number of families who've suffered terrible loss. We're joined by Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, who lost their son Gregory in the World Trade Center attack. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed?
My name is Phyllis Rodriguez. Our son perished in the first building of the World Trade Center on September 11th as part of this very public and tragic disaster. I would like to start out by reading a letter that we wrote, hoping it would be published and has been circulating throughout the internet and via friends and many media outlets. And it's called Not in Our Son's Name. We wrote it on September 14th. Our son Greg is among the many missing from the World Trade Center attack. Since we first heard the news, we have shared moments of grief, comfort, hope, despair, fond memories with his wife, the two families, our friends and neighbors, his loving colleagues at Cantor Fitzgerald Eastmead, and all the grieving families that daily meet at the Hotel Pierre. We see our hurt and anger reflected among everybody we meet. We cannot pay attention to the daily flow of news about this disaster, but we read enough of the news to sense that our government is heading in the direction of violent revenge with the prospect of sons, daughters, parents, friends in distant lands dying, suffering, and nursing further grievances against us. It is not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name. Our son died a victim of an inhuman ideology. Our actions should not serve the same purpose. Let us grieve. Let us reflect and pray. Let us think about a rational response that brings real peace and justice to our world, but let us not, as a nation, add to the inhumanity of our times. My husband, Orlando, wrote that after 3 days of conversations that the two of us had in going in and out of shock and despair at not only what happened on September 11th, but the growing conviction that our son was lost. We could not grieve privately only. We feel that it's bigger than all of us, that it's not as if he died in a car accident or in just some random accident. This affects all of us, and we are making every effort we can at this point to lend our voices to the rapidly coalescing and growing peace movement in this country and internationally. We feel very strongly that any Afghani death resounds in our family, that people should not be killed in the interests of stopping terrorism. There are other ways, and our government must rise above the bloodthirstiness that we hear reflected in the media and from our administration. And now, Orlando would like to say a few words.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Orlando Rodriguez.
Thank you, Amy. You know, we think a lot about this. It's very hard to avoid it. And one of the things that we feel a lot is that we know that Phyllis and I and our son and our daughter very often talked about capital punishment. And we always felt that if a member of our family was killed and the perpetrator was caught and tried and it was a question of capital punishment, that we would not call for capital punishment, that we would call for life imprisonment or something less than taking the life of another person. We now know that that's not just how we would feel, but that is how we actually feel. These are not individual perpetrators. This is more than that. And we don't feel just like a victim of a loved one's homicide. But in those early days, we felt like toys of people playing superpower games, both on our side and on the other side. And that is a feeling that we just could not cope with. We felt that we had to act in some kind of way. And that's why we wrote this letter.
We have seen a lot of grieving families speaking about their terrible suffering over the last few weeks. But we rarely see the second part, which is what you feel should be done. And I was wondering, in the interviews that you've done, and particularly in television, because it really is television that manufactures consensus, you know, that most people watch and are affected by, are they interested in your views about what should happen now that you've lost your son and so many others have been killed?
I don't know how the public reacts to it. I only know that many television journalists want to interview Phyllis and me. And happily, many of these journalists are from abroad. We were just interviewed by a Japanese news team who said that they were going to give 5 minutes to this story, which, you know, in media language makes it a very important story. We wanted to do this interview because we felt that this is not an American tragedy, it's a global tragedy, and that in order to stop any kind of mad response to this, it has to come not just from the American people, but it has to come from people abroad as well who pressure their governments.
I would like to add, Amy, that we did appear on two network news programs and got a lot of feedback from people who happened to see us. And I think that in some circles, you know, in commercial TV, we are seen as news. And I think that's good. And so there has been some exposure. We have been more sought after by alternative media organizations, however.
Is there an organization being formed of families of loved ones who are opposed to war?
Yes, I believe there is. We just, we have, you know, so much to do that we often don't get to our email messages for a couple of days, but we have one called Families of World Trade Center Victims for Peace. And we're going to investigate it, and one of there's a wonderful letter in it, actually, from someone who lost his brother in the Pentagon on September 11th, saying the same thing we're saying in different words. So we're very encouraged by that, and we're very interested in hooking up with such people.
If people want to get in touch with you, is there an email address or some number that would not be calling into your home where you're grieving?
Well, we're looking into there. You know, this is also new to us, but there is at least one clearinghouse, you know, for this type of communication that gets us messages without giving away our email address. And we have to look into that.
It's part of Yahoo, we know.
Well, I will get the information to our listeners and viewers around the country as soon as you know it in the coming days.
Okay, great. We will let you know then.
I was wondering if, Orlando Rodriguez, you could tell us a little about Greg, your son. I understand he was politically engaged himself in his youth.
Yes, he was, at a younger age, like many college kids, very interested in political activity. He had been involved in CISPIS, but also like many
the Committee
other kids,
in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador.
Yes, like many young kids, as they left college and went on to other things, then became more involved in questions of making a living and so on. But I think even though he did not continue to be politically active, he certainly was intellectually active and was as well active in his feelings about injustice of all kinds. And, you know, we fondly recall many conversations we had over the years about his feelings on all kinds of issues. I'm not going to say that that he was just, you know, mimicking what we thought. On the contrary, he had a very active intellectual life, and we had many debates about these things. But I think what I admire most about him actually was not his intellect, big as it was, but his heart, how he reacted instinctively to tragedies that he saw. And that is part of what makes Phyllis and me motivated to continue this, that we know that he would have had our approval about how we are going about reacting to this personal and public tragedy.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, for giving us these few minutes in your time of grief. And again, I hope we can keep in touch. And as you become part of this more formal movement against the war, we'll put out information.
That would be very helpful, Amy.
Great. Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez, our hearts here at Democracy Now! In Exile, still inside the evacuation zone, go out to you and your family on the loss of Greg. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, some words on war and peace from the Buddhist monk pacifist Thich Nhat Hanh. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. As we break the sound barrier, I'm Amy Goodman. I want to apologize for coughing before. We are in the garret of a firehouse, Engine Company 31 in Chinatown. We're just blocks from the World Trade Center, which, as you know, is still in the midst of tremendous search and rescue effort, and hundreds of more than 100,000 tons of rubble have been so far cleared from the site, though no person has been pulled from the rubble in many days. But for some reason, in the last few days, the air has become terrible around here, very acrid smell of smoke, more pronounced than it was a few days ago. There's also still police checkpoints at the end of our road at Canal and Lafayette. And now anytime someone comes up in the elevator, there is a burst of air, and it's filled with something it almost smells like tear gas or burning plastic. That makes it hard to speak. But anyway, we're going to continue now with a major address at the Riverside Church here in New York by Buddhist peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh. He's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. During the war in Vietnam, he worked tirelessly for reconciliation between North and South Vietnam. Thich Nhat Hanh championed a movement known as Engaged Buddhism, which intertwined traditional meditative practices with active nonviolent civil disobedience against the South Vietnamese government and the United States. Martin Luther King Jr. nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize. Thich Nhat Hanh's Buddhist delegation to the Paris peace talks resulted in accords between North Vietnam and the United States, but his pacifist efforts did not end with the war. He also helped organize rescue missions well into the 70s for Vietnamese trying to escape from political oppression. He now lives in exile in a small community in France called Plum Village. Thich Nhat Hanh has written more than 75 books of prose, poetry, prayers, and continues to be banned from Vietnam. He spoke on Tuesday night at the historic Riverside Church, where Martin Luther King first spoke out publicly against the Vietnam War. We played the first half of his speech yesterday in the second hour of our special War and Peace Report, and we wanted to bring our listeners and viewers in the first hour, the second half of this speech. It's called Embracing Anger. We pick up where we left off yesterday. Thich Nhat Hanh.
Can survive without food, including our love or our hate. Love is a living thing. Hate is a living thing. If you do not nourish your love, it will die. If you cut the source of nutriment of your anger, of your violence, they will also die. That is why the path shown by the Buddha is the path of mindful consumption. The Buddha said, there was a couple who want to cross the desert to go to another country to seek freedom. And they brought with them their little boy and a quantity of food and water. They did not calculate well, that is why half the way through the desert, they ran out of food. And they knew that they were going to die, all three of them. So after a lot of anguish, they decided to kill the little boy in order to eat the flesh so that they could survive and go to the other country. And that's what they did. And every time they ate a piece of flesh of their son, they cried. The Buddha asked his monks, "My dear friends, do you think that the couple enjoy eating the flesh of their son?" The Buddha said, "No, it's impossible to enjoy eating the flesh of our son." The Buddha said, "If you do not eat mindfully, you are eating the flesh of your son and daughter. You are eating the flesh of your parents." If you look deeply, we see that eating can be extremely violent. Even the school told us that every day 40,000 children in the world die because of the lack of nutrition, food. Every day 40,000 children. And the amount of grain that we grow in the West is mostly used in order to feed our cattle. 80% of the corn grown in this country is to feed the cattle, to make meat. 95% of the oats produced in this country is not for us to eat, but for animals, or is for food.
You're listening to Thich Nhat Hanh as we move to the second part of his address. Again, he was speaking at Riverside Church in Manhattan. It was a packed church. Thousands of people came out to see him. Many could not make it into Riverside Church. He spoke on Tuesday night, speaking about the issue of embracing anger, as we go back to that tape. And after that, we're going to be going to hear some comments of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. Well, Jerry Falwell on the Pat Robertson 700 Club. And we're going to be joined by representatives of the National Organization for Women and the Human Rights Campaign, which is a national gay and lesbian group in the United States. But right now, back to Thich Nhat Hanh, embracing anger.
According to the report I just got a month ago, all agricultural land in the U.S., 87% is used to raise animals for food. That is 45% of the total land mass in the U.S. That is about land. Water. More than half of all the water consumed in the U.S. for all purposes is used to raise animals for food. It takes 2,500 gallons of water to produce a pound of meat, but only 25 gallons to produce a pound of wheat. A totally vegetarian diet requires 300 gallons of water per day, while a meat-eating diet requires more than 4,000 gallons of water per day. Pollution. Raising animals for food causes more water pollution in the U.S. than any other industry, because animals raised for food produce 130 times the excrement of the entire human population. It means 87,000 pounds per second. Much of the waste from factory farms and slaughterhouses flows into streams and rivers, contaminating water sources. Deforestation. Each vegetarian can save one acre of trees every year. More than 260 million acres of U.S. forests have been cleared to grow crops to feed animals raised for meat. And another acre of trees disappears every 8 seconds. The tropical rainforests are also being destroyed to create grazing land for cattle. Resources. In the U.S., animals raised for food are fed more than 80% of the corn we grow and more than 95% of the oats. We are eating our country, we are eating the earth. We are eating our children. And I have learned that more than half the people in this country overeat. Mindful eating can help maintain compassion within our heart. A person without compassion cannot be happy, cannot relate to other human beings and to other living beings. And eating the flesh of our own son is what is going on in the world, because we do not practice mindful eating. The Buddha spoke about the second kind of food that you consume every day, that is sense impression. The kind of food that we take in by the way of the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. When we read a magazine, we eat, we consume. When we watch television, we consume. When we listen to a conversation, we consume. And these items can be highly toxic. There may be a lot of poisons, like craving, like violence, like anger, like despair in this product. We allow ourselves to be intoxicated by what we consume in terms of senses, impressions. We allow our children to intoxicate themselves because of these products. And that is why it's very important to look deeply into our ill being, into the nature of our ill being, in order to recognize the sources of nutriment we have used to bring it into us and to our society. The Buddha had this to say: what has come to be? If you know how to look deeply into its nature and identify its source of nutriment, you are already on a path of emancipation. What has come to be is our illness, our ill-being, our suffering, our violence, our despair. And if you practice looking deeply, meditation, you'll be able to identify the sources of nutriments of food that has brought it in to us. And therefore, the whole nation has to practice looking deeply into the nature of what we consume every day. And consuming mindfully is the only way to protect ourselves, our family, our nation, and our society. We have to learn how to consume mindfully as a family, as a city, as a nation. We have to learn what to produce and what not to produce in order to provide only with our people the items that are nourishing and healing. We have to refrain from producing the kind of items that can bring war and despair into our body, into our consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of our nation, our society. And Congress has to practice that. We have elected members of the Congress. We expect them to practice, listen deeply to the suffering of the people, to look deeply in order to understand that suffering, to see the real causes of that suffering, and to make the kind of law that can protect us from self-destruction. And America is great. I have the conviction that you can do it, and you can help the world. You can offer the world wisdom, mindfulness, and compassion. Nowadays, I enjoy places where people do not smoke. There are non-smoking flights that we can enjoy. 10 years ago, they did not exist, non-smoking flights. And in America, on every box of cigarette, there is that sentence, be aware, smoking might be hazardous to your health. That is the bell of mindfulness. That is the practice of mindfulness of consumption. You do not say that you practice mindfulness, but you are really practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness of smoking will help you to see that smoking is not healthy. In America, people are very aware of the nature of food they eat. They want every package of food to be labeled so that you can know what is in it. You don't want to eat the kind of food that can bring about toxins and poisons into our body. This is the practice of mindful eating. But we can go further, we can do better as parents, as teachers, as artists, as politicians. If you are a teacher, you can contribute a lot in awakening people, in waking up people on the need of mindful consumption, because that is the way leading to real emancipation. If you are a filmmaker, if you are a journalist, and then you have means in order to educate people, waking people up to the danger of our situation, every one of us can transform himself or herself into a bodhisattva doing the work of awakening.
Thich Nhat Hanh, the second part of his address at Riverside Church this week in New York, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk well known for opposing the war in Vietnam still can't return to his homeland, has written more than 75 books of poetry and prose. We'll play the last part of his speech tomorrow here on Democracy Now! in Exile, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back to hear the words of Americans, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. Stay with us.
I don't like old Satan, nothing he say or do. Tell one lie to hurt us all, then two to make it true. Yes, sign a judgment, yes. Sign a judgment, yes. Sign of judgment, time ain't long. I said, yes, sign of judgment, yes. sign of judgment, yeah. Sign of judgment, time ain't long.
Sign of Judgment, Marianne Faithfull, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting from inside the evacuation zone, just blocks from where the World Trade Center once stood, still police checkpoints at the end of our block. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 days after the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, television evangelists Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, two of the most prominent voices of the religious right, said liberal civil liberties groups, feminists, homosexuals, abortion rights supporters bear partial responsibility for the terrorist attacks because their actions have turned God's anger against America. On September 13th, during one of his regular appearances on Pat Robertson's 700 Club, a TV show on the Christian Broadcasting Network, Jerry Falwell said, quote, "And I fear, as Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, said yesterday, that this is only the beginning. And with biological warfare available to these monsters, the Husseins, the Bin Ladens, the Arafats, what we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve." And then Jerry Falwell continued.
"Well, the ACLU's got to take a lot of blame for this.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I'll hear from them for this, but throwing God off successfully with the help of the federal court system, throwing God out of the public square, out of the schools, the abortionists have got to bear some burden for this because God will not be mocked, and when we destroy 40 million little innocent babies, we make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen."
"Well, I totally concur. And the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible to free society for what the top people do, and the top people is, of course, the court system."
As you can hear, Pat Robertson agreed with Jerry Falwell's statements throughout. Several days later, Falwell and Robertson apologized after a White House spokesperson called the remarks inappropriate. Falwell admitted his statements were ill-timed and sensitive and divisive at a time of national mourning. He said, "I want to apologize to every American, including those I named." Falwell said a White House spokesperson had called him the day after he appeared on the show and told him the president disapproved. The outcry from commentators and social justice groups made a plea against scapegoating and blame and a call for unity during a time of tragedy. We're joined right now by two people, one from the Human Rights Campaign and another from the National Organization for Women. David Smith is with us from a Human Rights Campaign. Well, they apologized, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. So what's the problem?
Well, I think if you listen or read their apologies, they apologized for the timing of their remarks. Neither one of them apologized for the substance of their remarks. I mean, I truly believe that that's what Jerry Falwell believes, and so does Pat Robertson. And it was, you know, communicated clear as day. And Pat Robertson, being completely disingenuous, said that he didn't understand what Jerry Falwell had said, so he didn't know what he was concurring with. As you heard on your tape, you know, he went on to basically put an exclamation point after what Jerry Falwell had said. He clearly knew what was being said. And, you know, unfortunately, these two men represent, you know, another dangerous part of our society that we must be very cognizant about. We must be very conscious about what their activities are, because clearly, you know, they intended to be divisive and separate a group of Americans from what they perceive to be, you know, their mainstream.
Sonia Soria, with Now New York City, what was your response?
Well, basically that the damage is done, regardless if there's an apology there or not. The damage is done because they are able to reinforce already the themes that they have worked so hard to put out there to make their own ideology more successful, to win followers.
We were just listening to Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk, a very different message that he put out. But I wanted to ask you both, in the wake of the attacks, if you feel that there is a larger scapegoating going on of the progressive community in this country. Let's start with David Smith of the Human Rights Campaign.
I'm very much heartened by the almost universal condemnation about what Falwell and Robertson had said on this program. You know, support was coming from quarters that we have not seen in the past. We're not getting the sense that the progressive community is being scapegoated. We're much more concerned about the scapegoating that's going on with people of Middle Eastern origin or appearance. That is just a horrendous occurrence that's taking place throughout the country that we're very concerned about. And we actually, in our statement, and we wrestled with whether to respond to Falwell or not, because it was 2 days after the horrible tragedy. And, you know, people were very, very sensitive, and it was, do we raise these remarks to another level by responding to them? So we wrestled with it. But what we said in our statement is those two men, the remarks that they made were very similar to the scapegoating that's going on with people of Middle Eastern appearance appearance or origin, and that this blind rage, you know, this blaming blindly, is wrong, and we should all come together and condemn that as much as we can.
And Sonia Saryov now.
It just goes to show, you know, firsthand what can happen when extremism is allowed to flourish, and they are allowing unfortunately such a community that has not done anything is being shunned into their homes, and they are reinforcing this attitude.
David Smith, the Human Rights Campaign, and now New York City, right now after the attacks, are you changing any approach you've taken? For example, there's been a large discussion of how anti-war sentiment should be manifest, whether people should march in the streets. In your work now, David Smith, are you campaigning any differently?
I would say yes. We're being very conscious of the mood of the public. We're communicating, I think, much less. Our primary work is working with Congress and the administration on a variety of fronts. Obviously, new priorities have come forward, which has limited, constricted our ability to work with Congress for the immediate future. We expect that to return to normal at some point, and we'll be monitoring it very closely. But yeah, we've changed to some extent in trying to be very sensitive to the mood of the country, and also trying at the same time communicating with our own community. You know, one of the striking things about this, about Falwell's remarks was, and what was so painful for our community in particular, was reports were coming in of gay people killed in the tragedy. Well, all Americans have suffered. Almost everybody knows somebody who suffered that from this. But it became even more painful to know that Falwell was blaming a group of people that actually had been victimized by this, which we thought was, you know, even more contemptible.
During the Cold War, David Smith of Human Rights Campaign, gays and lesbians were targeted for a long time, persecuted, being called a national security threat, could be compromised, particularly in the military. What about the history of sexual orientation during wartime?
Well, what I can comment on, I mean, what I can speak to directly is gay people serving in the military before the Gulf War, and the military issuing what's called stop-loss orders, which basically prevent the or allow the military service chiefs to overlook or sidestep policies that would otherwise lead to a person's discharge. So basically what happened in the Gulf War, they stopped discharging gay people had them go to war, and when they came back from the war, they discharged them. So similarly, what's going on now is a stop-loss order has been issued, and the service chiefs are deciding what policies will be sidestepped. Only one so far, the Air Force, has chosen to specifically exempt Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So the bottom line is the Don't Ask, Don't Tell is in force, and if you identified yourself as gay, you'd theoretically be kicked out. But it remains to be seen what the other service chiefs will do. But we're obviously watching that closely. There's the whole notion of going to fight for the country and then coming back and being discharged is just not right.
How did you accomplish getting the Air Force not to enforce Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, we didn't accomplish anything. I mean, they're operating on their own. The Air Force, just to be clear, has exempted Don't Ask, Don't Tell from the stop loss, which means that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is still the policy. In other words, if you identify yourself as gay, you're going to be kicked out before you go. So it appears the military is handling it differently than it did in 1991. While the other services, Army, Navy, Coast Guard, et cetera, have not issued their orders yet, it looks as though that they're going to keep Don't Ask, Don't Tell in place. And so if you identify yourself as gay, you will be kicked out, war or no war.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. David Smith is a spokesperson for Human Rights Campaign in Washington, D.C. Sonia Sorio, Vice President of Public Information for Now New York City. Thanks for being with us. And that does it for today's program in the first hour. In our second hour, we'll be talking about the women of Afghanistan and look particularly at the South Asian community and find out what artists are doing to refuse and resist. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, Errol Maitland, is at WBIX.org, where you can hear us live streamed. Also, you can go to webactive.com. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoi No, Karen Renucci, Adrian Yannick, Didi Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, Sam Delgado, and also our hosts at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Special thanks to Charles Crizell and the Independent Media Center. Thank you to Pacifica Station KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, and of course all of our affiliates around the country. We are Pacifica. You can see the program on Channel 56 today and tomorrow on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as on CUNY TV, and we're on Channel 9415 of Dish Network. We are Free Speech TV. We're in the historic Engine 31 in Chinatown, the evacuation zone, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
She asked me why. I just went on and told her.